This is Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. A bit later in the program, the famous, infamous La Brea Tar Pits. That's an Ice Age era fossil site located in Los Angeles. A great place to visit if you are coming out to L.A. But first, a look at what has been called an emerging environmental problem. What happens to the countless pharmaceuticals and personal care products that we ingest every year, every day? What happens to them after we take them? They don't just go do their jobs and get used up. A good deal of the drugs we take are excreted and flushed down the toilet, finding their way into the environment. Researchers studying freshwater lakes and streams have found a medicine cabinet full of products in the waters there. Everything from antidepressants and birth control hormones to antibiotics, acetaminophen, suntan lotion. The drugs have shown up in streams in 30 states across the country and in the Great Lakes, and they may be causing unexpected changes to wild animals. Some suspect that the hormones are feminizing fish, disrupting the ratios of males to females that are normally found in undisturbed fish populations. And some scientists are concerned that the drugs in our water supply may be at high enough levels to affect people, perhaps children. Could it be? Well, no one knows just yet. A lot more research has to happen. But we'll be talking about that this hour. If you'd like to join our conversation, give us a call. Our number, 1-800-989-8255. As always, you can surf over to our website at sciencefriday.com. Let me introduce my guests. Herb Buxton is the coordinator for the Toxic Substances Hydrology Program at the U.S. Geological Survey. He joins us from his office in Trenton. Welcome back to Science Friday, Mr. Buxton.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to join you.
You're welcome. Dr. Brian Brooks is an assistant professor of environmental studies at the Center for Reservoir and Aquatic Systems Research at Baylor University, and he joins us from member station KWBU in Waco, Texas. Thank you for joining us, Dr. Brooks.
Pleasure to be here.
You're welcome. Dr. Chris Metcalf is a professor in the Environmental and Resource Studies Program and the Dean of Research and Graduate Studies at Trent University. That's in Peterborough, Ontario, Canada, and he joins us by phone. Thanks for being with us, Dr. Metcalf.
Good afternoon, Ira, and hello to all my colleagues.
Hello, Chris.
Hi, Chris.
Herb Buxton, there's a new acronym afoot, PPCP. Tell us what that stands for.
Pharmaceuticals and Personal Care Products.
And why is that getting more attention now?
Well, it seems that we have recent information that's making us understand that chemicals that we use in our everyday life and even consume, like pharmaceuticals, are making it to our environment and contaminating our water resources. We take them, as you described, they go through our bodies, or we actually dispose of leftovers. They go through the wastewater stream and aren't completely removed in the treatment process and wind up in our water resources.
In fact, on your webpage in the U.S. Geological Survey, under the question, which chemical compounds did you find most often when you did a survey, you found in 89% of the streams there were non-prescription drugs, 81%, insect repellent, detergent, metabolites, then disinfectants, plasticizer, fire retardants, antibiotics, insecticides, polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons, reproductive hormones, other prescription drugs, antioxidants, fragrances, and a solvent. That's like something that's in my garage, all of those things.
Well, they're in our house, and we use them every day.
Go ahead.
Many of these compounds that we see at very, very low concentrations, a part per billion or so, which is almost like a sugar cube in a very large swimming pool, to give you a very general analogy. But it's important to measure these contaminants even at very low concentrations.
Now, Chris Metcalf, you looked at water leaving the Little River. That's a river in Windsor, Canada.
Mm-hmm.
And you found all sorts of things. Tell us what you found in the water.
Well, it's a similar story. Of course, the Little River, why we chose it is that it's, as the name suggests, a small river in which the discharge from the sewage treatment plant comprises pretty close to 50% of the total volume of water. So we thought, well, this is a good worst-case scenario to take a look at. So we found a range of prescription and non-prescription drugs in the Little River, as well as antibiotics. And the Little River, in fact, flows into the Detroit River. Windsor is opposite the city of Detroit, and eventually obviously becomes more diluted by the Detroit River discharge, but is transported downstream.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it's a similar story to, I think, what the USGS has been showing. I think the most important aspect of all of this work is that traditionally, I think the public has thought of environmental contamination as being something that's produced by those nasty chemical plants or refineries, etc. And I think what we're beginning to realize in all of this is that we humans are a source of contamination as well. And I think that's been a bit of a wake-up call. People have realized that they're part of the problem as well.
Brian Brooks, tell us about the compound that you looked for in fish, fluoxetine.
Sure. Well, similar to Dr. Metcalf's approach in trying to identify potential worst-case scenario aquatic systems for studying these compounds, a creek that we've been working on for the last few years, particularly with our colleagues at the municipality in Denton, Texas, is a creek known as Pecan Creek, and it's a typical effluent-dominated stream. Again, the majority of the flow, unlike the Little River, in the summertime, the entire flow of Pecan Creek can be made up from the discharge from the wastewater treatment plant. And so we've been involved in a number of studies with the Pecan Creek effluent and the stream over the last few years, including studies on birth control hormones, heart medications. However, the most recent study that has been getting some attention, we had been performing laboratory toxicity tests to try to gain some understanding of what levels would we expect fluoxetine, fairly commonly prescribed antidepressant, one that certainly Dr. Buxton and Metcalf's groups have been looking at what levels might they affect aquatic organisms. So we did a fairly good job of characterizing these kinds of responses with standard toxicity test. Our next step was to take that into a field scenario. And so we chose, again, Pecan Creek, an effluent-dominated stream. We collected fish that are commonly found there, including bluegill, channel catfish, and black crappie. We then dissected liver, lateral muscle fillet, and brain tissues from these organisms. Those tissues were analyzed for fluoxetine. And
what, fluoxetine is the generic form of Prozac?
That is correct. That is correct.
Yeah.
That's correct. And fluoxetine is metabolized to a compound known as norfluoxetine, which actually is its active metabolite. And so we were interested in looking for both of these drugs in the tissues of the fish we collected. And in fact, we did detect and then quantify or quantitate fluoxetine in all the tissues that we sampled for.
And do you know if there's any effect on the fish from having ingested this Prozac? Are they laid back more now? Or, I mean, can you tell yet if there's any problem with that?
Based upon what we were interested in looking at in this study, we can't tell that. This was very much an exploratory study in that we sampled fish from an effluent-dominated stream, fairly typical of other aquatic systems in the arid and semi-arid southwestern United States, other parts of the country. This was, again, just an exploratory study, but that fluoxetine and norfluoxetine are being found in fish tissues is not normal. Our next step is to understand mechanistically what kind of consequences might this have to normal neurotransmitter levels in the fish. We're doing some laboratory studies in that arena right now.
What about in people who eat fish? That this is the fish eat the Prozac and people eat the fish. Could there not be a problem there?
Certainly a question that must be asked. The concentrations in the three tissues that we looked at, again, we were analyzing muscle or the lateral fillet of a fish that would be normally consumed by humans. We were also evaluating liver, where the compound's metabolized, brain, ultimately where it exerts its therapeutic effect. The good news is that the lowest concentrations were consistently found in the muscle. Now, that's what we would expect based upon what we know about the pharmacology, pharmacokinetics, and disposition of fluoxetine in mammals.
Mm-hmm. Chris Metcalf, what evidence is there that hormones in the water might be having an effect on fish? We've heard about the feminizing fish. Is there evidence for that?
Well, similar to what you just heard, the challenge in all of this is matching up what you see in the field to what you do in the lab. And certainly there's an emerging story there. What's been shown is in various field situations is that you'll find populations of fish which are fairly near sewage treatment plant discharges that are show evidence of feminization. So the most common thing to see is intersex of the gonads. So you'll have male fish that have bits of female ovary tissue in the testis. And then the question is, well, what's causing this? And that's where you have to go back to the lab, where some of the work that we've done and others have done would indicate that chemical, which is the active ingredient in the birth control pill, which is called phenylestradiol, can induce similar kinds of effects at extremely low concentrations, part per trillion concentrations. And that's well within the sorts of concentrations that you'll find of phenylestradiol in the environment where these fish that have developed intersex in that environment. And so by matching up the two sets of data from what you get in the laboratory tests to what we observe in the field, then we can say, well, it looks like phenylestradiol, which comes out of the use of birth control pills, might be contributing to that response that we see in the field. But you understand, it's a little difficult to get the smoking gun where you actually show that, but it's pretty good evidence that it might be occurring.
How would you get the smoking gun, or is that impossible?
It's pretty difficult to do. There has been some work in which done in Sweden, in which they found within the bile of fish exposed in the field that they can see residues of that phenylestradiol, the compound that's in birth control pills. So I think that's about as close as we're going to get in order to make that association.
Mm-hmm. Herb Buxton, are you finding these pharmaceuticals only in streams that are fed by sewage treatment plants, where the toilets and things we flush stuff out would be winding up in?
No, we aren't actually. The design of our studies is to try to find out the combinations of compounds that are in the water where the aquatic organisms are living. So we really look for similar type of pathways for those contaminants to enter the stream. So that human wastewater pathway is obviously one. Another is an animal wastewater pathway. More recently, there's been a dramatic increase in the number of concentrated animal feeding operations where we grow our pork and our cattle. These animals are also given some pharmaceutical compounds, antibiotics, growth promoters, and many of these concentrated animal feeding operations basically are like little cities. Cattle, for example, may produce about a factor of 20 times the manure that a person produces. A swine, perhaps a factor of two or more. And so this is another real pathway for these types of compounds to enter water resources. So we also looked at streams that are downstream of areas of intense animal production.
And there also is evidence of fish in the Great Lakes, which would be ingesting some of these, is there not?
Well, no, I wouldn't say that there's a lot of information on fish in the Great Lakes. You mean in terms of the residues that we might find of these compounds in fish in the Great Lakes? Certainly in one area, I can say, and that is going into the area of personal care products. We've been talking about pharmaceuticals primarily here. But some of the work that we've been doing on fragrances, which are added to, you know, underarm deodorant and also to our
All right, I'm going to have to break it. We'll come back.
Okay.
I'm sorry, we'll run out of time in the before the break, so stay with us. We'll come back and talk more about these chemicals that are showing up. Stay with us. I'm Ira Flatto, and this is Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatto. We're talking this hour about personal care products, drugs, other kinds of things you use around the the personal care products, possibly showing up in aquatic animals in some of the waterways, fresh waterways around the country. My guests are Herb Buxton, coordinator for the Toxic Substances Hydrology Program at the U.S. Geological Survey, Brian Brooks, assistant professor of environmental studies at the Center for Reservoir and Aquatic Systems Research at Baylor University in Texas, Chris Metcalf, professor in the Environmental and Resource Studies Program at Trent University in Peterborough, Ontario, on number 1-800-989-8255. And when I last rudely interrupted, Dr. Metcalf was talking about personal care products and deodorant showing up in the Great Lakes.
Yep, no problem. We were chatting about the fact that many of the fragrances that we might use as personal care products that are used in, say, underarm deodorants or in hair shampoo or also in detergents, etc., that we might use for washing our clothes, etc., they, of course, are discharged out through sewage treatment plants and make their way into the aquatic environment. And we have been detecting levels of these fragrances, which are appear to be concentrated in the tissues of fish in the Great Lakes region. And they're a little bit different from some of the pharmaceuticals that we've been talking about because they appear to be a bit more persistent and susceptible to accumulation in fish. And in fact, are getting up to reasonably high levels in some areas, one part per million, which doesn't sound like a lot, but in terms of contaminant levels, it's considered fairly high.
Mm-hmm. And the bigger the fish you have, the more it sort of stores the stuff in its tissues.
Not really so much.
Food chain?
It's a food chain situation where, as you go up through the food chain, it would appear that the concentrations of these compounds increase.
1-800-989-8255. Let's go to the phones to Beaufort, South Carolina. Hi, Maureen. Welcome to Science Friday.
Yeah, this is Maureen.
Yes.
I am interested in a this is a fascinating program. Thank you so much. I'm interested in opening up a discussion about the hormones that go into cows, you know, which turns out to be beef, and chickens, which turns out to be food on the table, and relationship to those hormones going into both young boys and girls. And those hormones, you know, girls, I've noticed, are getting periods at earlier and earlier time span. You know, so I think that is open for discussion. These hormones mm-hmm. are affecting our children.
Dr. Metcalf, any?
Oh, you're going to go to me on this one, are you?
That's a hot potato gets thrown in your lap.
Well, it is certainly an area of discussion, Maureen. And here's the issue: is that as we know, in many industrialized countries, children are reaching puberty earlier, and certainly that is very noticeable among young women. And of course, the suggestion has been there that this is a result of intake of hormones through the food that we eat. There is another possibility, and that is the fact that we are consuming higher fat diets, typically in our diets than we would have had 50 years ago. Cholesterol is the precursor, a compound for the formation of estradiol and testosterone and all of these hormones that we're talking about. So there is an alternative view that our changes in dietary patterns are what's fueling this noticeable change in age to puberty. So that is a possibility. Certainly, we need more data, and I know that scientists always say this. Well, I think we need to have more data. The food industry would argue that that the use of those hormones for as growth promoters, et cetera, in the beef cattle industry is stopped well ahead of the marketing time for the beef, and so that the hormones have all disappeared from the tissues.
Yeah. Well, them.
Well, so we need to sort that out and to determine. Obviously, having more stringent monitoring of mm-hmm. the food that we eat is part of that solution. Mm-hmm. So, for instance, just to give you an example, there's been a lot of interest lately in a compound called trenbolone, which is given to cattle. It's basically a a steroid compound which mimics testosterone. And so there's been a lot of concern about the use of trenbolone in beef cattle, which is given to them to put on more lean muscle quicker. And that's what we need. We need more monitoring. We need more research to determine whether this is a viable concern.
Yeah, and my concern also is that we don't have the funding to do that. We have the funding to support pharmaceutical industries. We have all and lobbyists to do so, but we don't have the funding for these important researches.
Well, I don't think you'll hear any complaints from the three guests today. That's a requirement. Is that I think providing the sorts of research funding from an arm's length kind of point of view is absolutely central.
Yes, thank you
so much, Maureen. Thanks for calling.
Thank you. Bye.
How do we know? Do we have any baseline data to know whether these things have been there all the time? You know, going back how many years, or are we just able to detect them now? Maybe they've been coming from other places.
Well, I've talked enough, so I'll turn it over to the other.
Well, I can say that that was an important question for the design of some of our early studies to determine whether or not these compounds are entering the environment. And the best way that we decided to approach that was to look for watersheds to sample that were unaffected or at least minimally affected. And so we did sample some watersheds that did not have much human activity or animal production, and we found significantly lower concentrations, didn't find as many compounds, but we still found and were surprised by finding things like caffeine, which we thought we had gone to watersheds that were pristine enough that we might not find even that. But we did find things like caffeine that we thought was a pretty good indicator of a human influence.
Yeah, it's not a whole, not a lot of coffee beans growing around here. What can you do if you find? Let's say, is there any remedial action you can take in a sewage plant to suck the stuff out of the water if it's getting in there that way?
Well, certainly that's the approach that's happening in Europe at the moment. The Europeans have been looking at this issue for perhaps the last eight or 9 years, whereas here in North America we're just starting. And I think the Europeans have gone through this process of realizing, okay, pharmaceuticals fill an important function in our society. They're here to stay. We would be, we wouldn't be doing society any good by banning them. So what do we do? And they have gone the route of working towards developing newer and better techniques to remove these compounds from the sewage.
Mm-hmm. It's an excellent point, Chris. And in fact, some of our work has been looking at the potential use of constructed wetlands as a polishing tool. And certainly, colleagues of mine at University of North Texas, I think in any study you have to have an excellent relationship with the municipality you're working with. And City of Denton actually has constructed a half-acre pilot-scale constructed wetland. And what my colleagues and then some of the studies I've been involved with has found is that constructed wetland appears promising to remove ethanol estradiol, some of the heart medications, and so I think as a potential lower cost the polishing treatment, it's another area that we should be examining.
You mean the wetlands will sort of, by bacteria or sunlight or something, break down the chemicals?
And potentially a combination of those mechanisms, as well as being taken up by the plant communities that are found in the wetland.
Could you make some of these personal care products a little different so that they self-destruct after a certain amount of time? Is that a possible thing?
Well, it's certainly possible to develop compounds which degrade more rapidly. Yes, and I think this is part of the regulatory process. Up until recently, the main interest in developing, for instance, pharmaceuticals was on protecting human health, and there all sorts of activity went into clinical trials, etc., the way it should be. And but relatively little attention was paid to the environmental fate of these compounds, what happens to them when they get in the environment. So potentially we could see more interest in providing that kind of information during the drug development stage. Of course, that will add to the cost of development, and that has to be taken into account as well.
You know, during the early days of the environmental movement, they used to see the detergents would be, you know, very evident because it'd be foaming up all the rivers. And then, you know, they made them a little more biodegradable and took some of the, you know. But this is not the kind of thing that is completely obvious to anyone, is it?
No, that's true. It's there's no foam on the surface to see in most cases. The kinds of equipment that you require to do these analyses to look for them are typically pretty sophisticated and costly, and I think that's been part of the reason why up until relatively recently we haven't been too concerned about them.
We've talked about the hormones, we've talked about some of the personal care products, and a topic that comes up often, which is we talked about the feedlots a little bit, and not about the hormones in particular, but about the antibiotics that get into the waterways, mm-hmm. could be creating the superbugs.
Well,
could they not?
Yeah, the antibiotic, the potential linkages with antibiotic resistance is an important criteria for the design of some of our upcoming studies. The antibiotic resistance is developed in organisms that are exposed to the antibiotics in the bacteria that are in their bodies, and then they leave their body, and certainly in the animals' bodies, and they've been found in waste lagoons outside concentrated animal feeding operations. But at the same time, you find a number of antibiotics in those waters at lower concentrations, and there are questions related to whether exposure of indigenous microbes we find naturally in streams and soils, as to whether they may develop antibiotic mm-hmm. resistance from low-level exposure to those low concentrations.
Let's go to the phones, 1-800-989-8255. Let's go right here to California, to Raul. And is it Nevada, California, Raul?
Yes. Well, Northern California, north of San Francisco. I've heard in the last 2 or 3 years that they've actually been finding traces of common drugs in the North Atlantic. And but my question really is, and I've heard that some of the absorptions of drugs are as low as 10 to 20% of the dosage. In other words, the body absorbs and processes 10 to 20% of the dosage of the drug, and the rest is excreted and returned to the waste stream. And since we were talking about cattle, if they're getting such high dosages of antibiotics, they're probably excreting the remainder back into the waste stream, and this problem of antibiotic resistant bugs is going to come back to bite us. So my question is, what's the percentage of drug absorption commonly assumed?
Yeah, well, so it's an excellent question. No, it's an excellent question. I was just going to say that this often varies by chemicals. There are specific chemical physical properties, the way that they're metabolized, ultimately determine to what degree they're going to be excreted as parent compound, primary metabolites, or in the case of fluoxetine, for example, only about 10% of what you take in is excreted from your body. But then there are other forms, like the primary metabolite, other metabolites that are excreted from your body.
Mm-hmm. Can I follow up a little? Wouldn't it then be valuable to study other methods of formulation of these drugs so that they would be more, the body could be more efficient in processing them, so they could, you could lower the dosage and thereby reduce the amount of drugs that get into the waste stream?
Well, it's certainly related to Dr. Metcalf's discussion. I think the whole idea of developing more green compounds, the area of green chemistry, is certainly interested in that. Chris, do you have anything to add on that?
Well, I think if you had to look at the trends in terms of the pharmaceutical industry, they're certainly working towards developing compounds that you don't have to renew on a daily basis. You take them, and then essentially the dose remains for a fairly long period of time in your body. To me, that seems to be where the pharmaceutical industry is going, and certainly a part of that, I think, will be a greater degree of metabolism and removal of mm-hmm. these compounds before they're excreted. But, yeah, I agree. And quite frankly, the pharmaceutical industry wants to go in that direction because, obviously, if they can reduce the amount of the bang for the buck, if you will, the amount that has to be ingested in order to get the therapeutic effect, that's a good thing. So I think we're seeing the industry move in that direction, and hopefully that will result in some improvements in terms of the amount that is getting excreted from humans.
We're talking about personal care products and the environment this hour and Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. 1-800-989-8255 is our number. Let's go to Norman, Oklahoma. Brad in Norman. Hi, Brad. How are you? Welcome to Science Friday.
Thanks for having me on. I used to work on a fishing vessel in the Bering Sea, and we, through the process of bringing up fish, brought up a stellar sea lion. I did an autopsy on it. I was a biologist for the vessel, and it turns out this was should have been a female sea lion. Cut it open, and it didn't have a uterus. It had vestepherons. So this was some sort of, you know, either delayed development or a hermaphrodite. And I got to thinking, we target fish specifically when they're loaded with estrogen, specifically when they're loaded with eggs. And we only take by weight about 12% of the mass of that fish is kept on board as a fillet. The rest of it's dumped overboard. And the marine mammals just track right along the side of the boat eating that, as well as all the seabirds and all those other shore animals that go back to shore and then cycle this through the system. I was unable to find anything when I got back to NIMS from the biologist there. No one seemed to know anything about it. And I was wondering how much of an impact does digested estrogen have on the body, because we fish for one specific fast food chain. All of our fish went to the fillets on fast food, you know, sandwiches. And they're all loaded, I assume, with estrogen.
Got about 30 seconds. Anybody want to tackle that?
certainly, I haven't seen any evidence that that the natural estrogens or synthetic estrogens accumulate in marine food chains. So in terms of the pharmaceuticals, maybe not. Maybe some other compounds which are estrogenic and are more persistent in tissues could have been responsible.
All right, gentlemen, I want to thank you very much. We'll certainly be following this issue as it gets more into the limelight. Herb Buxton is the coordinator for the Toxic Substances Hydrology Program at the U.S. Geological Survey. Brian Brooks, Assistant Professor of Environmental Studies at the Center for Reservoir and Aquatic Systems Research at Baylor University. Chris Metcalf, Professor in the Environmental and Resource Studies Program at Trent University, Peterborough, Ontario, Canada. Gentlemen, thank you all for joining
us. Thank you, Ira.
Thank you.
My pleasure, Ira.
We're going to take a short break, and when we come back, we're going to take a studio field trip, so to speak, to the La Brea Tar Pits. If you haven't been there, well, maybe you can stick around, listen to us talk about it, and take a trip on your own. Some very interesting bird fossils turning up at La Brea, so stay with us. We'll be right back after this short break. I'm Ira Flatow, and this is Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News.